forgotten how to do this.
It's been a long time and I've moved house.
Yeah, can you stop using that excuse? It'll be 20 years from now. I moved house. I can't do this anymore.
Well, it's a really good excuse.
Mine's going to be baby for the next 6 months.
Oh, well, if you can have baby, I can have moving house.
No, baby lasts longer, though.
What? How does baby last longer? I haven't unpacked my books yet.
Because babies can't hold their head up for like the first three.
Neither can my books.
Yeah, true. Fair point. You win. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. And here we are, back again, after a hiatus of up to 3 months.
I think three months, yeah.
Did we actually, is this our first for the year?
It is our first for the year.
That's amazing.
It's only March.
You know what's been lovely? That people have actually missed us.
They have. It's
only about
really
six
sweet.
Or seven, but still, you know, that's more people that miss me when I go on holiday from work. I turn up, my staff don't even know I'm gone. So,
yeah, but that's work.
Yeah, true. But, you know, that's quite a lot. Six people so missing
what did,
me.
What did you do on your holidays, Ian?
Nothing. I went. Yeah, well, it was enforced, you see, this holiday by you.
Yeah, well, I bought a house.
Yes, and you're now in that house. We're not recording from that house.
No,
though.
No.
Strangely.
This will now be a bit of a travelling podcast, I think.
Yes, but strangely we're recording from Dave's house.
Yes, Dave Hoskin.
Who's not home.
Who's one third of Shooting the Pooh.
And is not home.
But we snuck in anyway because all the key gear was here.
Yeah, we've literally broken into his house to record on the critic.
By broken in, we mean take the key from under the doormat. And he left us kindly.
And there was Dave, we'll listen to this one day. There was so much dust under that door.
It really was.
Asbestos.
It's like the colour of the porch under the mat is like two tones brighter than the rest of the porch.
I need danger money now for this podcast. especially if I'm going to have to get the fucking key from under the mat all the time. It was much easier with you. See, I needed danger money for when you were in your house.
Why?
Because there was that lead up to the driveway, which was on a 25-degree gradient.
Yeah.
And I you needed bloody crimps and things like that to climb up it. You know what those things are called? Like crimps or crimpons or?
Crimpons.
I don't know what I'm saying. But, you know, the things that you use when
you climb
up.
Like for mountain climbing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
okay.
That stuff. I needed that to get up the bloody driveway.
Yeah, but when you left, you could just roll down.
No, I couldn't because there were two cars in the way and really thorny trees on either side or bushes. And I often hurt myself and cried. On the way home in my car.
And now you have asbestos.
Yes, now I have asbestos.
Excellent.
So we're doing well. So thank you for those people who were genuinely concerned as if we would never return.
And we've got a little bit of bad news. Which we should probably get out of the way. Well, it's not bad news. It's actually amazingly brilliant news. You're having a baby. Well, not you.
Jules.
Your wife. Yes. Your lovely wife Jules is having a baby next month.
Yes. I won't say the exact due date because it's probably, you know, personal
but,
and confidential.
You know,
it's
around about the time we would normally have
the next
podcast. So we're skipping April.
Yeah, but we're probably going to go early May. So it won't be a 3 month break. It'll be something like.
No, it's just a 1 month break. We'll skip April. We're back in May and then back in June. And we have, I think in May we can have a special announcement about June. So that'll be fun.
Yes, that's right. We should probably do, you know, the rest of the year every month.
I think we shall try.
Yes.
Depends how baby things go.
So we won't be using your house as an excuse?
I hope my books are all unpacked by June.
Okay. My books, actually, that's one thing. You know what I did do in the time we had off? I took all the books out from where I used to stay. I had about 1,000 books there and I brought them into my garage.
God. That's a lot of books.
Yeah.
How many have you read of the 1,000?
No, those were all unread books. I've got probably a 1,500 unread books.
So you could not buy another book and probably be right for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Especially now you're about to have another new baby.
Am I abnormal in this?
I don't.
Can people write in, please?
I don't think you're abnormal. I think anyone who likes books and reading will probably end up with many unread books by the time they die. But 1,000's a lot. Like a garage full of books you haven't read.
Literally, it's four full shelves.
Literally a garage full of books.
And double stacked. I've had to stack them in ways that, you know, defy. So there are some of them that I actually can't see because of the way they're stacked. So I don't even know I own the book, which is why I'm using Goodreads now to slowly and methodically over the next 12 months scan every single book in there so I know what I own. That is a true story.
You should use the yellow-red card thing. That was really useful for me.
What yellow-red card thing?
Oh, when I had too many books and books that I just kept not reading – I put a yellow slip in them. I had 12 months to sort of.
This is the whole culling, you know, schemes to cull. And
oh, you're never culling?
No.
Oh.
I love them.
Are you going to build a house of leaves?
Yes, in a sense. Oh, good one. I see what you did there. Yes, but no, I love them. And yes, there are old books there that I'll never read.
So wait, you already know you have books there that you know right now you'll never read. No. So why are you keeping them?
I'll tell you why.
Like this is really interesting to me.
I'll tell you why. Because today I know I'll never read them. But what will happen is someone will say on a podcast or something I'm listening to about a particular book and I'll go, shit, I own that. I've now got an urge to read it and I'll read it.
So this happens
very rarely, but it does happen.
This is hoarding against the improbable event that you might decide to read a book that you actually don't want to read now.
Correct. Well, you obviously
wanted to read it at some point when you bought it. And in between that time, I was told it was good. Yeah. It's waned.
Well, no, that's not waned. It's just other things have appeared.
No, but it's waned because you're saying with these particular books, you now know you don't want to read them. So the urge comes back again, but between the time you bought that book and now,
yeah, okay,
you no longer, because I've got okay. books
no,
like
no,
that.
No, it's not.
I've got books that are sitting on my to be read shelf. I have one shelf, one shelf. It's full.
Double stacked?
No, it's a shelf on top of a bookcase.
Okay. How many books are in there?
Probably 30, 40 books. But they're not the only book. I have books in my main shelf that I haven't read. These are just the books I've ordered the last few years that I refused to put in the shelf because they would then become unread. They're there waiting to be read. But I look at some of them now and I look at them and I've probably even bought them in the last 3 years and it's like, I don't want to read you now.
Yeah,
so but I feel bad. There you are on my shelf. But I don't want to read you.
I'm not hateful towards the books. I just know realistically that
I'm getting a bit resentful.
Book from the 1970s by Barrington Bailey, I'm probably not going to read, or Mark S. Geston.
But you can't get rid of it. Is it a can't? Like, is it an emotional? I really can't get rid of it.
It is. I've got hoarding. I genuinely have hoarding problems. Now, my wife sorted all that. I mean, you saw our house today.
Your house is lovely.
Yeah. All the hoarding happens in the garage.
I will point out that it's a much bigger place than where you were, and it's quite empty now. But, you know.
No, but there will be no.
Houses abhor a vacuum.
Oh, no, they do. But there won't be any books, or at least very few, in the actual house.
Really?
Yeah. Not because Jules is against books, but because I know if I start, it'll never end.
Wow.
And we will, you know, suffocate.
That's interesting because I had to do a cull a couple of years ago when my now husband, Jason, moved in and he brought all his books and I had all my books and we had an astonishingly small crossover, actually. We thought we liked kind of the same thing. So we thought we might have, you know, as much as a 30 to 40% crossover with books where we could just get rid of a copy. And it was like, it was so small. It was like maybe 10%, probably not even 10. So we couldn't easily cull a lot of books.
Are you actually compatible?
Oh, yeah. No, it's good because what happened, it's funny because we do actually still like, we have a huge crossover in our reading, but for some reason, like, he's bought different things than I have. So I was looking at his collection going, oh, wow, I've been meaning to read that. And he was looking at mine going, awesome, you have that book. So it's good. But we did do a cull because we suddenly had way too many books for the space that we had and we were in a big house. So the likelihood of us actually getting a bigger house at any point in time was just about nil. So we had to do a cull and it was really hard psychologically to cull books that I would look at and go, I haven't read you. I've had you for 20 years. I'm probably not going to read you. And even harder in some way to get rid of books that I had read and didn't necessarily love. But it's that little thing of, well, you weren't bad. Like, I'm quite good at getting rid of a book that I've read and gone, this is terrible and throwing it away. I'm really good at that. But a book that I don't think is terrible, it's kind of hard to go, oh. And then there's also the expense side of it, like how much you've spent on your library. No. But I did this thing in where I tripped a little switch in my head.
Is this your yellow card?
No, no, no. That was a couple of years ago. Okay. Now I figured out. I could get rid of any book almost without feeling too bad about it.
Okay, tell me how.
Because I figured out, and this was also what got me into reading digital books a lot, and buying digital books a lot because I just flicked this thing in my head where what I was paying for and what I was getting and what I had was this wad of paper. Because actually, no, what I was paying for and what I'd done was I'd gotten that reading experience. And I've had that. Got what I paid for. this thing of paper that happens to be the medium through which I had the reading experience. And if anything, it's a souvenir of that experience, but that's all it is.
You might go back to that souvenir.
Maybe, but probably not. It's just another, like, you know, it's a drawer full of postcards that you'll never go back
to. But don't
look at.
You? Because I do it. I don't reread books, but I do flick through old books I've read for memorable scenes or
sometimes
for triggers.
I have what I'd hope, and this horrifies my husband Jason, but he doesn't listen to these, so he won't ever know anyway.
And Jules doesn't listen to these.
But what ultimately I'd really like is just a library of maybe 100 or 200 books max, and they're books that I really, really love. Like,
that's
I
it?
Love, yeah, but they're books that I love, like utterly, utterly love, and they're nicer.
You're not a proper bibliophile.
No, and they're nice.
You're not
additions.
A proper bibliophile.
No, I don't think I am. If you equate bibliophilia with the actual paper printed book, then I don't think I am anymore. I used to be. But I cured myself.
Okay. Well, I
because that's the thing. But that's what I'd like, right? Like a bookshelf of 100 or 200 books of books that I like. Every book on that shelf, I love. I absolutely adore. And it's a not necessarily a first edition or anything, but just a nice, you know, not yellowed and crumbly and papers falling out. Just a nice edition of books I love. And every other book I have can be a digital book.
No, okay, look, fair point.
And I'd love that.
And I'm
probably a few years working up
I'm
to
a big
it.
E-book
Jason
fan.
Might never ever work
I'm
up to it.
I'm a huge e-book fan because the amount of unread e-books I have. Nearly probably eclipses
the garage.
What's in the garage, yeah. But I still buy probably 50 or 60 paper books a year, which is a lot less than what
which
I used to.
Which is more than what you'd read, though.
But it's double what I read. Yeah. I probably don't read 25 novels, more than 25 novels a year, which is terrible.
It's not terrible. I don't think it's terrible.
Look at people on the interwebs. They're knocking out 70, 80, 90. There's someone who said recently they'd read 500 books in a year. I mean, they had a reason.
So what?
But I feel jealous. I'm jealous of their superpower.
Okay, if you're jealous of the ability that they can read quickly.
Yes, that bit.
Rather than thinking they're somehow better than you because they've read that quickly.
Possibly that too. But it's definitely, like, the first bit.
I went up to the Sydney Speculative Fiction Festival up at the New South Wales Writers Centre last weekend, and I was talking to Kate Forsyth, who ran it and launched The Wild Girl. Oh, I'm so looking forward to reading that book.
I actually bought that as an
ebook. No, I have the book and it's beautiful. And the stories, the anecdotes she told, so looking forward to reading it. But anyway. She's an incredibly fast reader. She actually is a speed reader. All she did growing up, because she had a childhood where she was quite ill a lot of the time, she read. That's all she did. She just read. And she got really, 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 really quick at reading. So she can actually read almost by the page turn. She's one of those really quick readers. And
how do you do that? How do you parse the words? How do they have time to seep into your brain before you've gone to the next sentence?
Well,
and I'm not talking about savoring a sentence. Yeah. I'm talking about just basic comprehension.
Because the way some speed readers, maybe I don't know a hell of a lot about it, but I mean the way Kate was talking about it was that you don't read every word anyway. You don't read the ands and the this and the as and the his. I mean, you don't. Like, read them with focus.
Okay.
You're grabbing the important words out of a sentence and a paragraph. And when you learn to read like that, I read like that, something approaching that, I think, when I was studying and academic stuff, because that was, right, it's much easier to do that kind of thing. And you still know
what
you're reading.
But I call that skimming. I don't call that reading.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're getting everything out of it.
Yeah, no.
But the point is, and I felt, on one hand, I felt jealous, but it wasn't a jealousy.
It's like a soup without salt.
No, I disagree. But I think people have different ways of reading, and it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter if someone can read 100 books or if someone reads 10 books, if they've enjoyed those books they've read.
Yeah, but then I walk into the garage and get overwhelmed.
Well, that's
by all
that's,
these books screaming at me saying,
else.
You fucker mond, you bought us, and you did buy us. You spent money on us.
You did.
What are we doing? And by the way, why am I double stacked behind this shitty book by X author? And you can't even see me. You can't even see me. You don't even know I exist.
That's another problem. I think once the books start to talk to you, you may need therapy.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, we should get onto the books because
well,
this might be really long otherwise.
Well, it's funny you should mention about I should mention because I don't think you mentioned it about how little books I read. I think I said how little books I read.
I don't think
you told me. But because when you're reading A House of Leaves or An Infinite Jest, which we're talking about today, you start to feel extraordinarily guilty that, you know, because it took me 49 days to read Infinite Jest.
Yeah, I'd believe that.
Yeah, and it took me about 35 days to read House of Leaves, which...
Oh, okay.
If I read quicker because it's shorter. It just doesn't seem short. It is shorter, though, because some of it's pictographic.
It's definitely shorter.
And you think, wow, well, Infinite Jest, 49 days, that's an entire month plus quite a chunk of another month. Yeah, how many books could I have read in that time?
But that's only if you base your reading on a quantitative measure rather than a qualitative
measure.
Doesn't
everyone in life do that?
I think possibly to some extent, which is possibly to the detriment of humanity.
Possibly you're right.
Yeah, once you actually start placing quantity as a measure of worth above quality, I mean, sometimes quantity is important, don't get me wrong. You buy a box of Maltesers, you want all your Maltesers in there. You don't just want one really perfect one. But privileging quantity over quality is not good in certainly not in the arts and not a lot of human spheres. So,
look, I don't regret the 49 days I spent on Infinite Jest.
49 days. I love that you know that. Because that was a few years ago that you read it.
2 years ago.
I know that because I've had that book in my house for many years. Looking at me balefully from
the
shelf.
Whose idea was it to do the Infinite Jest House of Leaves podcast?
I can't remember now.
I think it was yours.
It might have been mine.
Because you wanted me to read House of Leaves because I had always gone on about it being shit without having read it because it looked pretentious.
Yes.
Aren't I going to be eating my words in this podcast? spoilers for what's to follow.
Yes.
But we're going to start with
Infinite Jest.
Yes. So I recommended this.
You did.
This is also a book that I was meaning to read for about a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So every time I'd go to Perth, I'd go.
You'd take Infinite Jest. No. Did you have to get separate, like, checked baggage for that book?
No. But if I was on a trip to Perth, whether it was Swancon or to see my parents-in-law, not that I wanted to see them, but anyway, they're in town today. But that's whatever. I would go into Planet Books, and they always had a copy of Infinite Jest, and I would always pick it up and.
I don't have baggage allowance to get this book home.
Well, so. True. But then I'd notice that the main text is written in what I would think would be 8 font size, New Roman 8 font, around about that. And the footnotes, are written in 6 font. I mean,
not quite, Schumann size font, but still.
I wear very thick glasses. So I'd look at that and I'd notice how some of the sentences would go on forever.
Mm.
And I thought to myself, life's too short. I really can't be bothered. But each time I'd go into Perth, it would reinvigorate it. And then one day I said, fuck it, I'm going to buy it. And it wasn't in Planet Book. And then I got a real panic on about it and anxiety.
Oh, no,
the
copies are gone.
Yeah. I ended up buying it, I think.
It was probably the same copy in Planet Book over those 10 years.
Yeah.
And they finally sold it and Robin went, woo, it's gone.
Yeah. So 1,079 pages, 388 footnotes and close to 500,000 words of text.
Yeah.
Possibly the James Joyce or the Ulysses of the late 20th century because it's the book that everyone will talk about but no one has actually read.
I was about to say in that context, yes, yes.
I'm not necessarily in terms of quality. Also, a fantastic science fiction novel that never got nominated for a Hugo, which is why I was carrying on in my review about 2 years ago, which I'm going to say less about here because, to be frank, it's a stupid argument. But because I realise, now that I know that you have, because you didn't finish it, we'll get to that in a sec.
No.
There's very good reasons why this thing didn't get nominated for a Hugo in 1997. It's because
no one could read it.
Yeah.
I mean, within the 12-month voting period of the Hugos.
Although, can I ask, you didn't finish it, but did you read the David Eggers introduction?
No, because I never read introductions until I finished a book.
That's
because
your problem.
I like going in fresh to a text. I don't like – I mean, introductions are fine, but I've been spoilt by introductions before, so now I make them afterwards.
The Eggers forward is actually a pep talk. About reading the book,
right?
It isn't like one of those where you'll see this theme, that theme, this happens, that happens. Isn't this smart?
Hunker down, stock up on the water and the tins of baked beans.
Says this is not an easy book. Everyone knows that coming into it. You're not picking this up thinking it's a beach read over the summer holidays. Although that's probably a good time to read it over the summer holidays. But this is something your brain is going to have to engage with. And I think he says it gives your brain a thorough workout. But it's a pep talk because it does say keep with it, don't give up. And I kept coming back to the egg because over the 49 days that I read it, I would read some days 20 pages, some days 3 pages. Some days I couldn't get through a page without just wanting to turn myself in. But I kept coming back to what Eggers was saying. I thought, no, let's persevere. And then you hit a point with this book, for me anyway, and it was just beautiful.
Yeah, I probably didn't hit that point. As you can – well, listeners can't see, but Ian can see – by the little coloured sticky notes that I've left in it. I got about a third of the way through. And I think it's funny. It's not that I wasn't enjoying it, because almost every time I read some of it, I didn't enjoy what I was reading. It's very funny and very dry, and I mean, there are certain bits where I did actually chuckle out loud. It's not that I like dreaded. Well, I did kind of dread, especially in bed. I think this book almost broke my nose a couple of times.
Well, it slipped out of your hands.
Yeah, I've kind of felt this book. I fell asleep during the reading of more than any other book. But I actually don't – like, I don't think the book is soporific. I think I was as you've heard, listeners, I was moving house. So I was very tired and spending my days unpacking and packing boxes and moving furniture around and all the sort of stuff that you have to do and battling with Telstra, who is our telecommunications giant in this country, to get internet on. And so I wasn't actually really getting to read much of the book until night when I was already tired. And it because it's such a dense text – you are quite actively reading this book. So I think my brain would just go, oh, we're lying down now, sleep. And then I'd get hit in the face with this book. And
so this is making – hearing you say that and noting how reasonably clever you are, Jonathan Strahan, who has been against this podcast for some time, not the whole podcast, this episode, that we're doing Infinite Jest, because he thinks – quite clearly thinks that you shouldn't be wasting your time reading a book like this.
Well,
because
yeah.
Because life is too short and there are other things to read.
I've got to say, I've left unfinished many books in my life, particularly over the last 10 years when I, you know, post the dreaded equation and I realised exactly what you just said, life is too short to finish a book you're not enjoying. But I would say I think Infinite Jest is probably the first book that I would consider being – a defeat. Like, I don't feel like I abandoned the book because I didn't like, I felt like the book beat me. It just beat me. And yeah, I don't know. It's sort of, I wasn't feeling by the first third of it. I could see where the separate stories were starting to come together, but I just wasn't feeling this cohesion in the book. And it remind actually almost from the, not from the beginning, but from about maybe, I don't know, the first 80-odd pages or something, I remembered, you know, the film Wonder Boys, which is based on the Michael Chabon novel?
Neither have I read or seen, okay. But I know the film.
There's, you have an author academic who spends, he's played by Michael Douglas, he spends half the film most of the film actually in a pink dressing gown, because he's kind of got writer's block, he's got the opposite of writer's block, he can't finish his book because he can't stop writing it.
Okay.
Like, he's just constantly writing it. And he can't find the end. He's got a young female student who kind of idolises him, and there's a bit of a crush thing happening. And she says she gets to read these reams and reams and reams of manuscript at one point without him realising she's read it. And he comes in and sees her reading it and is a little bit affronted. And then he says, well, but what's it like? How dare you? Is it good? And she said something that's always stuck with me, because he was also a lecturer at the university. She said, you know, it's like it's all good. It's all really good. But you've told us that writing a novel is about making choices, and you've not made any choices here. You've written everything. And that has always kind of stuck with me as one of those little writing things. It's about making choices, about letting threads go. It's about choosing the best things to say rather than all the things to say. And just parts of Infinite Jest, that little thing, just it's like you're not making any choices.
Yeah, no,
David.
But he is, though. Oh,
choices.
No, but he is. He, you see, this is where not finishing the book, you don't know.
I know.
No, look, this is a book where the plot actually happens between the sentences.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually happen in the text. And that's the choice he's made. He's made a choice of not actually – the story's all there. You have to figure it out, though, after. And everyone's criticised the book. Well, the people who have finished it and then have said, oh, my God, I can't believe I fucking wasted my time reading this. It's because the book ends abruptly, very abruptly, and then you realise, oh, shit, that first chapter actually is the – end of the book, sort of, but that between the actual end of the
when
physical book.
When he's at the interview at
the
tennis
interview and he can't
academy,
speak and
yes.
he seems to be yep. mute and mm-hmm. what's going on to hell.
Yeah, it's a psychical book.
Yeah. So, and you don't know that necessarily going in, and if you haven't read the book, this is a spoiler. But what it is the physical. It's not like the physical end of the book and the first chapter link. Mm-hmm. They don't. There's a massive gap. There's shit that goes on,
right?
But that all that shit that happens at the post end of book to the first chapter is hinted at throughout the other 1,078 pages. You just have to fit it all together, and that's what Foster Wallace says. He says that's essentially the choice he's made. He said, "It's only a successful book if you're able to piece together the bit that I haven't written,"
which is why a lot of people,
yeah, that is his choice. He's going to absolutely throw all this information at you,
and you've got to sift through it.
Yes. Yeah. And there are lines, and really, it's because people have done it. I didn't, but there's 15 years of internet work on this book.
I can see,
and actually, it's the same with House of Leaves. There's 12 years of internet work on that book too, of people piecing together the bits and pieces of the crucial bits of the plot that make this come together, and that's. And for a lot of people in the world, and I don't blame them, why the fuck would you bother? There's a certain type of brain character
that is my type of brain. And I couldn't, and as I said, I don't know whether it was situational. I am going to give this copy back to you. Because
I'd like it.
Maybe I will finish it one day.
That is so well thumbed, by the way. Look at it.
That would probably. Was this new when you got it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Brand new.
It would probably necessitate starting again. But I would give it back because I certainly don't want to read it in the next year or two. But yeah, I don't know. It's like I said, it wasn't that I wasn't necessarily enjoying what I was reading, although there was some where I really. Wanted to just skim through.
What about did you get to the parts about alcohol?
Yes, and I was that was hilarious.
Hilarious, but also extremely disturbing.
Yeah.
And if you want to have a basic plot idea of what this book is about, it's essentially two strands, sort of. Even that's not entirely accurate. You've got the tennis academy on one side, where our main character Hal Incandenza. I'm doing this off the top of my head. Well done, Ian.
Yeah.
Hal Incandenza is a tennis pro, much like David Foster Wallace was. So that's bringing on to David Foster Wallace's tennis experience, and it's his time at that academy which his mother runs, and his father's dead.
His father founded it.
But his father found it. His father was also an auteur filmmaker, mm-hmm. and one of his last films was a film called
Infinite Jest. Well, it was his last film.
His last film was a film called Infinite Jest, which when you watch it, it drives you insane.
Blissfully insane.
Yeah, blissfully insane, yeah. Correct.
And it's kind of a like a lost film.
Yes,
like
that's it's not, right.
And people are kind of looking for the film throughout.
That's right,
the book.
Which is hilarious considering we're discussing House of Leaves. Yes, but anyway, alongside that, you've got a drug addiction rehabilitation clinic. Clinic. We get the there's a Dan Gately, I think, is the main character's name in that side, and there you get the story about Dan, but also about all the people who are being treated at this place, and all there's two main themes that I picked out of this book, which one is dysfunctional families. Which definitely goes back to, again, Foster Wallace to a degree, because Foster Wallace's background, which I don't want to go into huge amount of details because you can all find on Wikipedia, his father was a philosopher, academic, he lived in an academic life. Again, that sort of all comes out in the book. The second thing is Foster Wallace's real interest in both A, addiction, drug addiction, but B, rehabilitation of drugs.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So that's the second theme that comes out. And he's mushed them together into this story about a film that gets lost, which to be frank, is such a minor part of the story, and yet it's critical to the unseen plot. That's the genius of this book. The unseen plot, the plot that you have to pass together and figure out, is that's where Infinite Jest, the film that's lost, is critical. But if you're just reading it, you'd think, what the fuck? Everyone says it's about a film that makes people blissfully happy. There's like six scenes in the whole book.
Well, you do get suggest like the wheelchair assassins.
But again, all that stuff seems like what's that doing there?
Is it because the twin stories seem to be Hal and his time at the academy, and then the inhabitants of the rehabilitation clinic, and at some point which I hadn't got to yet, Hal goes into the clinic and
those
stories sort of join.
Do you know that after he gets out of the clinic, he and Dan and Joelle, I think her name is, go and dig up the dad's corpse?
No.
See, that's all hinted in there.
Oh.
And because in the dad's head is the copy of Infinite Jest. It's actually in his skull.
From the microwave suicide.
Yes. It's in his skull.
Right.
And
how did it survive the microwave?
I don't know. And that's probably also explained. And Oren, his brother, is the one who steals it. and then gets revenge on, because he was loved his dad, gets revenge on people who are critical of his dad by sending it to them. But the assassins are looking for it to bring down the American government.
And so, the American government's looking for it to stop anyone else using it.
And the reason why it was created in the first place, this is explained in the book, by the way, is because Hal ate some mold when he was very young, therefore became a detached personality. He could no longer feel or cry or anything. His father was really concerned about that. So his father had a plan to bring that about, which was for Hal to take a drug called DMZ and to watch the film. Okay. And both together would somehow bring him out of his shell or make him connect emotionally with the world.
Right.
That's the plot.
Right. Thank you. I don't have to read it now.
Yes. And neither does anyone, actually, now that I've explained it. But you won't necessarily you can piece that together reading it, but you won't necessarily get that reading it, if that makes sense.
Right.
Because what is Foster Wallace? Oh, I'm so passionate about this book, aren't
you
I?
Are.
I haven't stopped,
really
have I? Foster Wallace focuses on specific characters and moments and ideas. It's all about ideas. Lots of little ideas that have popped in his head one day. And like your Wonder Boys example, it's him sitting there going, you're right, saying, oh, shit, I've got this great idea about why people don't use
video phones. See, I like that. See, there were these bits. I mean, that's because
– And that game, the Eschaton, whatever the game is called, that he makes up in the book. You didn't get to that bit, did you? That's towards the last half.
No, not if it's in the last half.
They all play this game. All the kids of the academy play this game, which I've got written out what it's called, but it's this complex United Nations type game where they're all battling against each other. And he goes on into great detail. And normally I'd say, fuck, I can't be bothered, but it's brilliant.
And that's it. Like all of, as I said, when I was reading it, the bits I was reading in themselves as discrete parts were usually quite funny or, intelligent, or there was something about them that was really cool.
Eschaton, that's a game.
But yeah, I don't know. I just
they're short stories, aren't they? There are a lot of great short stories.
There are, and it just felt like such a slog. And yeah, like I said, it's the first time I felt like a book actually beat me. And it's one I won't read you. You win. Go sit on the shelf.
Yeah,
in your splendid isolation.
I mean, Dave, whose house we're borrowing for this podcast, has read Foster Wallace's nonfiction.
His nonfiction is great.
Yeah, and he's not, and it's shorter, obviously.
Yeah, but it's great. It's witty. It's but also like serious, and his voice is really clear. And this is I don't know. I just couldn't come at it. And I may never read this book.
It's a shame because I'm
although
telling you
it's one of these.
There are some bits about AA towards the end, and so that you're up bawling your eyes out. And again, it's not necessarily that Foster Wallace is critiquing Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just this intricate. Well, no, but it's also an in-depth, intricate.
He's using Gately to criticize the whole AA structure, and especially the.
He's satirizing it. There's no doubt about that.
Mm.
But at the same time, I think he feels. He feels for the victims,
and
there's intense, minute exploration of their issues, which is just unnerving to read.
Yeah.
And I wish I could just pick out all the great moments.
Can you do that?
Yeah, no.
read it again and to highlight them as you go through, and then I can just...
And just give them to... Well, no, I'd give them to the world. In fact, I'm annoyed that one of his followers... Because they do feel a bit like followers. Now that he's dead as well because he committed suicide, they do feel even more like followers. Haven't actually taken the book apart and say, look, for those of you who...
They would probably regard that as blasphemy
of
some kind.
It would be heresy. But no, create a schism.
Best of infinite jest.
No, I'm saying a schism should be created in the Church of Foster Wallace. And as part of that schism, someone, you know, one of the Antichrist popes should literally take this book apart and pick out the key, not just the key, not the key plot scenes, the key genius moments, of which there are a number.
There are, but it's a big patchwork quilt. I mean, he's throwing in urban myths and social commentary and absurdist humor and that's just like it is this big patchwork quilt of a book.
And he's making commentaries about corporations.
Yeah, subsidized time is really good. The way a corporation can sponsor a whole year, so you'll have the year of the depend adult undergarment.
And then, of course, rather than repeat that, he just does it in acronyms. Yes. The book is filled with that.
And Onan.
Yeah, Onan. Yeah,
that's really
great.
Government.
Yeah.
That's one of the best jokes in the book.
It's the most obvious joke.
It's one of the best jokes in the book. Because the whole book is full of scatological humour anyway.
And you do feel he is wanking himself off.
It's totally reliant on that. So, no, I like that the organization of North American... What's the other?
Nations, isn't
Nations,
it?
Yeah. North American nations, yeah.
And the Canada's become a rubbish tip. Yes. Full of mutants.
The great concavity.
Yeah.
Or convexity, depending which side you...
Yeah, it's, that's the other thing. I think he takes the, and this is going to sound ridiculous.
It's definitely a science fiction.
Yeah, well, he takes the SF elements seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, it becomes, you didn't get there, but there's also the ghost of Hal's father, the maker of Julian or whatever his, I can't remember his name, who appears towards the last third of the novel and, in fact, possesses the guy who's going to play the tennis match with Otho Stice or whatever.
Yeah.
But so there's a fantastical... magic realism. It's not really magic realism because it's genuinely a fantastical bit where the ghost of his dad who escaped the grave when Oren opened up his skull and took out the bit of infinite jest.
Oh dear.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. It's all in there. It's not 1,079 pages of just him pulling his part.
No, I know. And
it's about 500 pages of him pulling his part, but there's definitely other stuff. The footnotes. Tell me about the footnotes. You must have read some of those.
Well, I read up to what I stopped reading it. Like I did go, I had two bookmarks in this book. I had my bookmark and then had a bookmark in the footnotes that I was up to.
Because your book, House of Leaves, also has lots and lots of footnotes.
It did, but I
but they're at the bottom of the page.
Yeah, whereas these are endnotes in Infinite Jest.
It's the battle of the endnote footnote between these two books.
Well, the thing is with the footnotes here, though, I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. To be honest, I mean, there's a whole bunch of footnotes that I can see are more substantial, but certainly in the first third that I read, they just seem mostly irrelevant.
They're to break concentration. He's said that a number of times.
I know, but it's like, well, yeah, I don't know.
And that's why he's not at the bottom of the page.
I know, to make you turn to the end.
Yes, he wants you to do that.
Yeah.
That's what a cock of a thing to do. I highly recommend, and we might make a link to it if I remind Kirsten, his interview with Charlie Rose.
Oh, yeah, that's a good interview.
Where he talks about this.
Yes.
And that's
a very anxious interview.
Well, that was Foster Wallace. I mean, yeah, it's very hard to watch him speak because he's sweating and he's very.
How long was that before he committed suicide?
Oh, years, yes. Because that interview came out in 98 or something. So he only committed suicide a few years ago. Okay. And so he's sweating bullets. He's self-deprecating a lot, like more than is funny. It's not just ha ha.
Yeah, no, it doesn't feel like humorous self-deprecation. It feels like genuine self-deprecation.
Yeah. And you feel like Charlie Rose is having to, you know, counsel him as they're doing the interview.
Yeah, it's a very interesting interview.
Is there a genius at play here?
Oh, I don't believe in genius.
Oh, don't start.
No, I don't.
Really?
Yeah.
Albert Einstein was just a really smart guy. I'd just pick him because it's the, you know.
Well, define genius.
What do you mean define? What, do you want me to get a dictionary out? What do you mean define? I mean someone who has the capacity to see beyond the four walls of our existence and come up with ideas or inventions that change the course of our lives. Now, does this book... Because people do say reading this book has changed their lives.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
People will say that about anything.
No. This is a novel. The thing about Ulysses is that they say, not I, because I've not read Ulysses, that it was the last gasp of doing something really smart with narrative.
Well, they say that about lots of things.
Although you could say that about House of Leaves, but we'll get to that. But if it adjusts, is it doing anything really smart or clever with narrative structure?
I think, no, undoubtedly it is.
But not in an influential way, not in a way that you could then turn it into a movement. As distinct from, let's say, Chuck Palahniuk, who's actually got there's a minimalist movement out there.
Yeah, but...
based on that type of writing.
But
what?
Well, that's a counter argument to the idea of genius, because genius is something that's
individual,
solitary, right, and irreplicable and so on. So if it's something that can become part of a movement, then how is it a work of alleged genius?
All right.
Shouldn't genius be something that sits on the pinnacle and it is never able to be touched because it's this singular...
But the product of genius is what influences us.
Yes.
But someone had to come up with it.
Yes.
Okay, so this is going to be a circular argument very quickly. So Foster Wallace, he's just another author.
No, he's not just another author. It's just I think the word genius is bandied about far too often. I think it's a very intelligent book by a very intelligent writer. And it's a very challenging book, and I was not up to the challenge. I'll give it that. I might have been in at another time and place, but no, it was. But it
smacks of the university book, doesn't it? The sort of thing you read when you're an undergraduate.
Well, actually, no. I think it would be remarkable if that was assigned to a syllabus, because that would take up all reading.
No, I don't mean assigned to a syllabus. The sort of book where a university student who's doing an arts degree or something reads Infinite Jest, as you know, that's what they do.
Yeah.
A rite of initiation. You smoke marijuana. And you read
I think we might come back to this discussion while we're talking about House of Leaves, because there is something I wanted to. Which I guess comes up with the idea of genius and so on about these two books and why possibly one of the reasons they have such a cult following. But did you have anything else to say about...
No, I want to say, just a couple of very quick things. First off, I dare say that 90% of you will agree with Kirsten on this, even if you've not picked up the book, that it's a battle not worth fighting.
I didn't say it wasn't worth fighting.
Well, if Kirsten says she was defeated... I think if I was listening to, if I had not read this, if I'd not read this book,
and I should not be anyone's litmus test for reading stamina.
And I was listening to this podcast, knowing your tastes and the sort of person you are, and you said this book defeated me, I'd say, yeah, okay, it's not worth fighting that battle.
But other people might look at that as a challenge.
Well, for the 10% who do see that, I highly.
I'm telling you, I haven't had this talk. I'm feeling a bit challenged again myself. So. I have to go round two with this book next year.
Yeah, I think give it 12 months and come back to it. And you can always have my copy if you need it.
I think if I did that, I'd have to buy
my own. You can download it illegally off the web, but it's impossible to read because people haven't.
There's no actual digital copy? No, there isn't.
There isn't. And no one's hyped. They haven't hyperlinked the footnotes properly. Don't ask. Anyway, the point is.
That's cheating, isn't it? Hyperlinking the. I guess if it's a digital book, you have to be able to do something. It would be something. Yeah.
Well, the fact of the matter is the fact that they haven't hyperlinked it means you have to do that. Mm. So it makes it very tough. Anyway, the point is, so that was my first thing. So most of you will probably agree with Kirsten, but I will say.
I'd be very interested to know if any listeners have that was like how many point. Listeners finished.
Yeah, I would like to know, if anyone actually did read it in the last 3 months and who's read it prior and what they thought. I really would. Oh, look, I could control the internet and find a million views on.
I do have a feeling that it is one of these books which is going to sort of jag at the back of my mind, and I will – eventually, within a few years, go, fine, I'll go back and read you.
Well, everyone who has read this, explain without giving – oh, fuck, spoilers.
Even knowing the plot, because I don't think that's the point of the book.
No, it's not. It's not. But please explain to Kirsten why she should persevere or go back to this in 12 months or whatever time and read it.
I think I'd have to go back. I didn't think I'd have to. I think I was
– And if I hear silence –
I think I was far too scattered. Reading it the first time, but
if the response we get is silence, then I'm going to be disappointed with our listeners. No, I am.
I think Jonathan Strahan's out there having a party.
He is. He's absolutely having. See, Jonathan, you're not a good boy.
But I'm.
Look, you should be telling people to broaden their science fictional minds.
I'm not saying this is not a book worth reading. I'm not saying it's a bad book. I'm just saying I couldn't.
Okay.
Could not finish it.
And notice I haven't berated you.
And I apologise because I feel bad. I feel it was a book that would be worth putting in the effort to read if I had the time and the space to do so.
I just don't want you to become the poster girl or boy or man or it or entity, whatever. The poster entity of, see, she didn't finish it, why should you? That's the tagline.
I think you're Infinite the jest. Only one who said that.
Infinite jest. Kirsten McDermott didn't finish it, why should you?
Yeah, I think you may have just made that the tagline.
House of Leaves.
Which is the one I recommended to you.
Yes. Now, you know what disappoints me about House of Leaves?
You didn't read the colour version?
I have the colour version right here.
Oh, have you?
No. What disappoints me is that Blair Witch came out a year before this.
And he did take 10 years to write this book, though.
Yeah, but Blair Witch came out a year before.
Yeah, but he took 10 years to it, which means he was writing it for many, many years before Blair Witch was even probably conceived.
Would you like to describe House of Leaves to us, Kirsten?
Yes, I will. This is actually the second time I've read this book. And it was one of those books that it was published in the year 2000. So it's 12 years old, 13, 12 to 13 years old now. And as I said, Danielewski took 10 years to write the book. So. And it's not really surprising that amount of time. And it's essentially a story within a story within a story. The story at its core is a story about a haunted house and a family who moves into the house,
yes.
And explores the mysterious spatial anomalies within the house.
Yes.
And then that story has been recorded by one of the family members, the husband, Navidson, who is a photojournalist.
Yes.
And so he set up cameras because he was going to make a documentary anyway about his family moving to Virginia and you know, just a nice documentary about a family moving into a new house and all this sort of stuff. So he, you know, he's got cameras and all this stuff set up anyway. So the Navidson record is this film that was made about their experiences in the house. Then you take another layer away and you've got a guy, I can't think of another way to say it, a wannabe academic, Zampano, who has written a very long treatise called House of Leaves about the Navidson record, and doing an analysis of the film and bringing in a lot of third source subject matter and all this sort of stuff. And then on your outer layer again, you've got a character by the name of Johnny Truant who has discovered the writings of Zampano, who's been mysteriously killed in his apartment, and discovered the manuscript and the writings and journals and everything, and is putting together the book that we are reading right now.
And an academic text referring to a film that doesn't actually exist.
Well, I was about to say. So that's the structure of the book. Yeah. That's like a shell game.
There's a fourth structure you're not talking about, the editors.
Oh, and then, well, then, yeah, maybe he's putting together the book we're reading now.
Yeah, no, so you've got Navidson's.
And then you've got the editors of the book you're reading now, yes, who have been corresponding with Truant and have little footnotes of their own here and there.
Yes.
But at the core of it, the manuscript that Zampano has written called House of Leaves appears to be in the world of the book, which is meant to be our world, about a fictitious film. So Will Navidson, his partner Karen Green, and their two children never existed, and the film, the Navidson record, never existed, and Zampano, for reasons best known to himself perhaps, was just writing a fake academic treatise about a book which never existed, and some of his
about a film that never existed.
About a film that never existed, about people who never existed, and some of his footnotes reference actual books in the real world, and some of his footnotes reference fake books. They don't exist. And Johnny Truant isn't often sure what's real and what's not. So it's a book which is sort of a Russian doll type structure, and it's got various points of verisimilitude and reality and artifice and hoax. And one of the things which scared Ian away from reading it for so long is if you just went to a bookshelf and picked this book up and just flicked through it, you'd see the non-traditional layout of the book, which uses lots of different fonts, lots of different colours. If you've got the colour edition,
the typographical
layout, sometimes crazy typographical layout, literally. And the novel has the feel of a dossier of a sort of, yes, not a general novel, but of someone who has compiled.
Yeah, it feels like a sheaf of papers sources that have been put together.
On my edition, they have a quote from Bret Easton Ellis on the cover, which says, "A great novel, a phenomenal debut, thrillingly alive, sublimely creepy, distressingly scary, breathtakingly intelligent," which might be a little bit of hyperbole, especially when he goes on at the back to say, "It renders most other fiction meaningless. One can imagine Pynchon and Ballard and Stephen King and David Foster Wallace bowing at Mark Danielewski's feet, choking with astonishment, surprise, laughter and awe. I feel privileged to be among its first readers. Will I ever recover?"
Yeah.
Love Bret Easton Ellis. He does hyperbole very well.
I doubt Foster Wallace would have been bowing down at...
But so that's the structure of the book, and that's the basic, I guess, setup of the book.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Why is it House of Leaves by Mark Z. Danielewski? Why isn't it
author.
House of Leaves? No, he's not though.
No, he's the author.
No, he's not. No. This is the thing that I found odd about this.
You wanted to take it that extra meta level and make it House of Leaves.
He's done all this work, and unless he's put his own name on it to show that it is all artifice.
Yours has got a novel at the bottom, so you know.
I know that. Thank you. Unless he's put his own name on it,
yeah,
to show that to signal from the very beginning, it's all artifice.
Yep.
But he's worked so hard. I'm surprised it's not House of Leaves by either Zampano or Johnny Truant.
Well,
that he didn't go that far. To, look, he
could, it's got on the front title page of your book. It's got exactly that, right? Yeah,
it's got Mark Danislowski's House of Leaves by Zampano with an introduction notes by Johnny Drew.
Yeah, so that's exactly what it's got.
But it doesn't have it on the front page. I didn't understand why.
Because it is ultimately a work of fiction, and the author is the work of fiction.
But he's taking the metafictional ride so hard.
Yeah,
it's so hardcore.
Well, no, it's not. You know, it's not real. Come on.
look, I just felt like a missed opportunity.
Creating a work of art, and he's not. He's playing a lot of games with the text, but ultimately, he's creating a work of art, and he's not hiding that. He's not trying to pretend this is a real book. We've all seen a lot of real books that are out there, right? He's not pretending that. He's not saying this is a real book. He's not saying, I found this manuscript. He's saying, here is my work of art.
Yeah, all right.
You know, and he's. I think that's very deliberate that he didn't try to release it as, you know, with some sort of doubt as to whether or not.
Okay.
This is his work of art.
And my second point
is, he has created that. It's nice that he's got the title page, which that shows you where the art begins. It begins when you open the cover.
Okay. Well, my second point is, because you've provided a decent answer, again, this, like Infinite Jest, is a book where the plot happens in between the sentences, because actually the real story is all in the appendix about his mum, about Johnny Truant's mum.
It's a story. That's supporting documents.
Look, I trawled the bloody internet after this.
I know.
And okay. Feel free to give me your interpretation.
Well, theory I know that's around is that Johnny Truant's mother actually did the whole thing. And the whole thing is a work of her.
What's her name? Persephone?
Perfina.
Perfina, yeah, okay.
And the whole thing that you're reading from cover to cover is a work of her insane imagination, because she's been locked up.
She had a son called Johnny Truant.
Or is it doubtful that Johnny Truant had a mother called Perfina?
Yes.
Or is it doubtful that Johnny Truant even exists?
Yes, that definitely is doubtful. But again, there are people who have gone through this book with a fine tooth comb, and the prevailing theory is that it's written by a crazy woman in an asylum who may have had a relationship with a man called Zampano, and has created this entire universe for herself, including a son that doesn't exist,
who's written the book.
Which you'd only – and you can, again, piece that together from a very, very careful reading of the main text and the appendices, of which there's about 36 of them at the back.
Yes, yeah.
So where – and this has got footnotes, but where Infinite Jest has got 388 footnotes, this has got about – I don't know how many appendices. It just seems to go on forever.
There are footnotes, but the footnotes are, as we've said, footnotes.
Yeah, but then there are the appendices at the back.
But there and there's a couple of pointers in the as you're reading the book to suggest you could go read that bit of the appendix now if you wanted to, I actually think it's an incredibly unlike Infinite Jest. This is an incredibly readable book.
Yeah, it's amazingly accessible. This was my thing. I thought it wouldn't be. That's why I wouldn't read it, because I thought with all that typographical nonsense in it. Which now, reading it, I realise, shit, that's really smart. I thought, this is not going to be accessible at all. This is just going to be – it's going to – first 10 pages will be normal, then it'll just be gibberish for 300 pages, and then that's what I thought it would be like. But that's my own prejudices and, to be frank, stupidity. But reading it, you realise that the academic essay that Zampano is writing is really readable and accessible.
It is.
And post The Shining, this is one of the scariest things I've ever read.
Oh, that's a bit cool. But there are some really genuinely creepy, creepy moments in the description, in what is an academic description of a film that doesn't exist. Genuinely disturbing and creepy moments.
That's one little, I suppose, plot hole I had, that this is an academic text, and yet he's making a point of describing every single bloody moment that's in a film that everyone's meant to know about. So it'd be like Star Wars to describe every element of Star Wars.
Yeah, sure, except... As is pointed out by Truant and also by the editors, Zampano A wasn't an academic. I think one of his assistants who actually – because he hired – he was blind. Yeah. Zampano was blind. So he actually hired a lot of young girls to come and read to him and help him research and stuff like that. And one of them actually also makes the point that she was telling him, look, you don't put this stuff in an academic book. And he said, no, well, you know. And there's that line he has where you everybody's after an expert, but sometimes you need an amateur or whatever that line is. It's something along the lines of that. In that,
it's a bit convenient, but I understand.
But he's not an academic, right? This is the thing.
Okay.
And when you start an academic career, you look at first year university seriously. You look at how much exposition of the subject matter there is, and it's practically half the essay is a retelling of whatever novel or film or something that they're writing the essay about. It's what you do when you start before you're told this isn't what you do. Assume the reader knows.
It's right? equivalent.
And he's not an academic. And he's putting this together. He's trying to write this academic treatise, but he doesn't really know the structure of it.
Kirsten, if it's a criticism, it's a very minor one. Yes. It's a very minor quibble. Because
explained and excused within the text.
Yeah, and I thought that was contrived, but okay, fine.
Oh, wait, the whole thing's contrived, though. There's so many bits.
And then you sort of go and say, well, why? Infinite Jest beat you, and there's a lot of contrivances in that. Why would I bother reading this? It's just a bit of control. It's a wank. It's 900 pages of wank. It isn't. I love this book. I want to be clear. Yeah. I love House of Leaves because it's genuinely creepy and scary. There are bits in here, and the way he uses white, the way he uses silence and space is just
astonishing. Well, the way he
but because of the contrivance, you could argue it's just why should I give a fuck about anyone in this? Why should I give a fuck about Nat Davidson?
Why should you give a Johnny fuck Troy? About any character in any book? No, but seriously, why? They're not real. They aren't real people. This stuff actually hasn't happened to them that you're reading about.
Fair, but look, I suppose this comes down to the issue of the unreliable narrator. Yeah. Now, that's used a lot, and it's usually used to provide a twist or something in a book. Here, it's all unreliable from go to woe. There is nothing, even the comments from the editors is unreliable because you think this could be all in the mind of a crazy woman in an asylum.
Well, if that's your reading of it. But the other thing. One of the remarkable things about this book is that you don't get any central conventional narrative about the Davidsons. The whole descriptions about them and what they go through in the house and after the house is told from a third person quasi analytical point of view, right? And yet that they come across as so real and characters you really do empathize with and really do care about. And it's so scary. Especially what happens brother. To them, right? Oh, Tom. Yeah. You know, but we don't get – it's not like in the middle of this book there's a first-person narrative by Will Davidson or Karen Green or even Tom. It's not. It's the description of this film, this documentary film. That's all we get, and yet they're so real, and you care about them, and you're scared for them.
That's fundamentally the genius of this
book.
And
it's a remarkable
book. I know, because we're quite intelligent. I qualify this. Here we go. There is a lot of contrivance here. You give a shit about all the characters, including Johnny Truant.
I mean, there's bits which are slightly annoying to me when I thought he's using the Zampano device to make explicit bits of symbolism or something like that where you think really the reader should be able to pick up why, you know, Will did that or said that or why, you know. Because he can use some Pano to say, oh, well, blah, 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 blah.
And you said it yourself. That's part of the amateur academic in Zampano.
It is, but I mean.
Oh, wow, is that a contrivance, is it?
That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think Danielewski needed to necessarily fill in all the gaps with stuff. Sometimes it did feel a little like he's going, see what I did there? See what I did there? Except he's not saying it, Zampano is, so he can get away with it because he's letting Zampano explain to the reader why he's done this really clever bit of symbolism or metaphor or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The book straddles a fine line between trying to show off how clever how do you pronounce it?
I mean,
is it Danielewski?
I've been saying Danielewski. He may pronounce it phonetically. I don't know.
But Danielewski will do it.
It's mainly with literary allusions and stuff like that. He does it a lot, right? There'll be an literary allusion somewhere, and you'll have Truant explain. If Zampano doesn't explain it about Davidson, Truant will explain it about Zampano. Yeah. So, the author Danielewski leaves you in no doubt as to how clever he is and where all his allusions are coming from. And you don't feel upset with.
With him,
mostly not.
Well, I didn't at all. I came in
mostly not. Sometimes I think, yeah, come on.
I was prejudiced to begin with, so I would have my radar would have said, okay, you just think you're a tosser, aren't you? Yeah. But I love these characters so much, including Johnny. I didn't like to begin with. I thought, oh, can we get away from Johnny Truant?
Let's just
give
it to Truant. Takes a while to establish himself as a proper character in the story rather than just a convenient narrative trope.
Yes, that's right. You know, that's exactly
the person
right.
who's found the thing that you're going to then.
And again,
about.
And I think that is done on purpose. It's
possibly
it'd be silly to establish Johnny as such a strong character when the focus has to be on the text of the Davidson thing. But as Johnny goes slowly and surely crazy as well, because everyone basically goes mad in this. More or less. If they don't go mad, they get I think
they're all damaged.
They're all very damaged. Yes,
by the end, they're all damaged.
So
or dead.
If he'd established Johnny as a fully fledged character at the beginning, the focus wouldn't have been right. So it's the smart way of doing it. But I was going, no, I want to go back to the Navidson stuff. Don't stop segueing with Johnny. But then Johnny began to grow as a character, and then it's both.
And he's a very unreliable. Like he himself doesn't know what's real or not.
No. He's
he can't differentiate pretty much by the middle of the book. Never mind the end, between fantasy and reality, and what has actually happened and what he's imagined happened, and certainly by the end, you just can't believe a word of his narrative, really. Which is interesting in itself.
Is this a gothic book?
Oh, it's absolutely a gothic book.
Yeah.
This is one I talk about when I talk about the gothic and how the gothic can be done in a contemporary setting easily and to great effect, and it's not something that's left behind in Victorian England or something like that.
What are the symbols that make it a gothic book?
The fact that this is a haunted house story is just high gothic. You can't even get away from that. But it's more that the strength of the gothic is that it has a focus on emotional intensity, almost sometimes to the point of hysteria, and I use that word advisedly. And it also has a strong focus on relationships between characters. And not necessarily romantic, like familial relationships, the relationships between characters, which can be used as like a clothes horse to hang themes of betrayal and loyalty and love and hate and all, like it's high stakes emotional stuff. That's what the gothic does best. And it's also something that plays with layers and secrets and stuff that's said and not said, and sort of a surface level of meaning under which there's all this stuff happening.
Yep.
And that's all sort of classic tropes of the gothic, and a lot of people still associate that word with sort of the Victorian sort of novels, but it's just a sensibility, and it's a focus on a work that's about
and this
something.
Has it in drives.
Oh, absolutely. And as I said, this is the book I hold up and say, this is how you do the gothic now, without writing a historical gothic, without doing a house in the country. This is a suburban house in Virginia. It's not in some it's got neighbours. It's got a real estate agent who come by. I mean, it's not some –
That scene with the real estate agent pops up at the end, that actually made me laugh. Yeah. With all these people fucked. And she's going, what the fuck's happened here?
This house sells a lot. Yeah. this is a fantastic example of a contemporary gothic
novel. And it has
novel.
A sort of vague Lovecraftian feel to it as well. The anomaly. Without having a Lovecraftian monster at its core –
Yeah.
That sense of ancient.
Well, I guess it's the
cosmic ancientness.
It was the spatial stuff and the depth of the anomaly, maybe.
Well, there's a cosmic element to it.
There's a belief that there might be a cosmic element to
fuck
it.
Off.
No, but there is. This is what Navidson and Reston
and that was that was one of the funny bits where where they take samples of the anomaly,
they're so old.
But how Zampano accidentally or by deliberately ink or something or scratches out a lot of the actual explanation bits.
Oh no, it was that Johnny Truant left a bottle of.
Oh,
ink
that's right. Yeah, that's it.
You know, coincidentally, it's inconvenient. This really important stack of papers, which had all these scientific. findings of the samples from the house and how old, like impossibly old they were, is actually, yeah, being just soaked in ink and is
And yet legible. You can still pretty much figure it out. It's not...
Yeah, I think I could forgive some of the more convenient contrivances just because of, I mean, you're reading a novel. It's like every novel you read, it's not real. Every word of every book you read is contrived. And when I think we've had a similar discussion to this before, the idea that you can have a very seamless sort of quasi-invisible reading experience where you just read the text and you're not thinking that you're reading a book, yep, so to speak, but you know you're reading a book. And then you'll have a different book, and House of Leaves is one of those where you are actively reading a book, and at all points you know you're reading this book, which has been carefully made for you to read, and I appreciate that because if it's done well, it's something you appreciate. This is something that visibly on every page the author has gone to great effort to craft for you to read. Cool. Thank you, Mark. I'm enjoying it. So when sometimes I think there is unnecessary exposition in terms of, well, not exposition, but explanation of references and so on, I think, yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay. Look, yeah. I think because this Blair Witch comes out in 99, mm, and since then there's been a whole heap of found mm-hmm, something. Now, this is one of the very few found manuscripts. Well, I mean, Red Tree does it. Caitlin Keenan's, yep, Red Tree does it. I mean, it's not like it's not done before. Well,
Red Tree came well after.
I know. I'm saying it's not saying that it's not something that had. What I was trying to say is it's not something that this is unique. It's,
oh, no, like, no. Found manuscripts. Found manuscripts. Old trope.
Yeah.
I don't know that anything has been done quite to this extent.
No, this is.
Before House of Leaves.
I think the filmic versions, though, do pretend that they are real.
Well, the Blair Witch certainly did. That was meant to just be found footage. Well, I think the paranormal ones will pretend that they are. I think
they all do, more or less, pretend that they are, in fact, real pieces of footage. This one, as you say, and I suppose by putting his name on the front cover, he's saying, no, this is all art. This isn't real.
People. What's that as Blair Witch? I mean, come on.
People believed it. I don't think anyone...
But then people are stupid.
No, people believe Blair Witch, genuinely believed it.
Then I think they're a bit silly.
I know they are. I know that. I mean, the famous one is Ghostwatch, the UK show that was done. It was done on Halloween.
Oh, the hoax.
The hoax, yeah. The hoax. That was also a haunted house.
But that was different, though, because that was done.
But it's not found
and
footage.
It wasn't found footage, and it was bracketed as a television show, and this is what they were doing. And it was quite different. I think when you go and see Blair Witch at the cinema, I mean, for God's sake, look at the bottom of the film poster. It's got directed by, you know, starring. It's it is as much as House of Leaves is about what you're going to see is art, and we're doing the best we can to get you to suspend your disbelief and believe this is found footage. And I think, I mean, I love the Blair Witch project. Just the first one. I'll be very clear. Just the first one. And I think it's a really good film, and I love the ending. I love that you don't know that there's no as it had to. And a lot of people complain about Blair Witch that you get to the end. It's like, oh, is that it?
It's a guy banging his head against a wall and some noises going on in the background, which meant to be screams, which you can barely hear.
Well, but that's how the witch said. Anyway, I'm not going to go into it. But my point is, it kept within the confines of its own medium. It couldn't, what could it do? How could it end? Like, how could it actually end?
Yeah, people want someone to turn up and go, well, this is what actually happened.
And also, more importantly, and I think, and this is one of the reasons I love Blair Witch and one of the reasons I love House of Leaves, is it refuses to give you a pat explanation.
Yes.
It allows you to have this, much like The Red Tree, Caitlin Kiernan's novel, it gives you all this stuff to take away and think about and you know, enjoy while you're watching or reading. And it just says, there you go. This is what we have.
So what's interesting is that it didn't actually win
a Bram Stoker Award.
So Infinite Jest didn't get nominated for anything. This got nominated for a Stoker for Best First Novel.
Yep.
Do you know what it was beaten by?
No.
Can I tell you?
You can tell me.
It was beaten by The Licking Valley Coon Hunters Club by Brian A. Hopkins. There you go. I'm not making that up.
That's a classic that has gone down in...
Yes, I know. 12 years later, I've still never heard of that book.
Wow.
Yeah.
The Licking... I can't even say it. I'm going to say it wrong.
Yeah. It's not what you were thinking. I'll say the Licking Valley Coon Hunters Club.
It's just about what I was thinking.
Well, I think it's playing on that idea. I don't think he's picked those words as a fluke.
No, I don't think so. Nice.
It was up against Nailed by the Heart by Simon Clark, which I am aware of. In fact, I own
mm-hmm.
House of Leaves. The Licking Valley Coon Hunters Club, which won, and Run by Douglas E. Winter, which I also own, but I've never read. So the only one of those I've never heard of is the one that won.
Well, there you go. I think you should track that down and read it.
Look, it's
tell me
great.
If you think it's better than, it's House, better than of House of Leaves. Yeah.
I don't know what that says about the Bram Stoker Award.
Moving on.
I suppose at least they nominate. Well, yeah, anyway. Here's the thing. The point I raise that is 12 years later and 15 years later for Infinite Jest, these books are still being spoken about, not just on podcasts like this. I mean, there are forums on the internet where people are talking about this shit. There aren't that many books, Bible aside, where people are still spending time actually having flame wars and discussions and academic discussions on pieces of text.
Actually, like it's funny you mentioned the Bible.
It is.
Well, because what I was going to – remember I said earlier we'll come back to this conversation? Because I think one of the reasons that books like House of Leaves and Infinite Jest – do inspire such ongoing debate and discussion and obsession, let's face it.
Yes.
Some of these people, they may never read another book in their life. They may just reread these books over and over and over and over. Is that I think because these books are at their core, they're a riddle or a puzzle, and they're not one that gives you the answer at the end. You have to find the answer. Right, with both of them, you can't. It's not like it's mysterious going through and you don't know what's happening. And then you get to the end, it's like, oh, that's what it was. They refuse to do that. You've got to find that answer. And there may not even be a single answer.
So all the left brain people get really compelled to.
So it taps into that idea of the mystery, and the mystery without a definitive answer. You can never prove that your theory about House of Leaves is better than someone else.
Mark Z. Danilevsky and say, am I right?
Well,
Foster Wallace is a bit harder.
He's dead.
But you've had 15 years before he died to ring. No. I mean, death of the author aside, this is the Bible's a bit different. The Bible.
I was being a little facetious. I'm just saying it's that sense of the mystery and that sense of something which isn't really knowable. Because I mean, honestly, even if Danilevsky came out and said, "Okay." Here's exactly what it is. How many people on that Zed forum do you think would really go, oh, okay, well we're done now?
Shut it down today.
Do you think most of them would start arguing with Danilevsky about what he actually said the novel was about? And quite rightly pointing out that there's probably a whole heap of shit in there that he's not even aware he put in there.
Yeah, and I think he'd been smart enough to actually, as you say, put multiple explanations in.
So, and this is the thing. This taps into this very human need to solve the mystery. And to reach towards the unknown and make it known, which is also what is at the heart of House of Leaves. It's Navidson's need to know what is wrong with this house because it's this spatial anomaly.
Yeah, no,
for people
who
haven't read the book, and this is not a spoiler because it's straight away. The house, shortly after Mark and Karen and their two kids move in, the house exhibits this funny anomaly where there's this hallway that not only wasn't there when they moved in, but it's longer than is physically possible for the house to have. Like it should, if you stand in the house looking at the doorway, it should be going out into the backyard, and you go into the backyard and there's the wall of the house. And then they go in and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's it. It seems to reflect possibly the personalities of, and the desires and the ambitions of the people who go into the anomaly. And all of this is reflecting a reading experience. A book is bigger than just these pages, right? You read this book. This is bigger than that. If I gave you that book and said, is that House of Leaves? It's much bigger than just these pages I'm holding in my hand.
No, it's millions of megabytes on the internet.
But I'm saying it's huge, right?
Yeah, it's huge,
It's big. And any book is bigger than just this wad of paper you're holding.
Yeah, I agree.
And you bring to it and take away with it to some extent what you have personally as a reader, what your past has delivered to you in terms of the connections your mind makes, how you interpret things, what you do and don't know. So what you can bring to a book, and you take away with it to some extent the attitude you bring, how you interpret things. I mean, House of Leaves are the book, the pages, right? This is, the book is about the book, and it's about story, and it's about narrative and reading. And one of the most remarkable sections is the middle bit where it's Zampano's well, there's actually two or three of these sections of the typographic text where you have very either very little text on a page or text at angles or footnotes which tunnel through pages.
They do tunnel.
And they're meaningless. They're lists. They're
well, one
endless,
of them is a list.
And so you
the architect, all the architects.
You go down these footnotes which go over pages and through pages, and they're just this list, and you get to the end and there's like this blank wall and you've got to go back. And this is describing the explorations within the house, which is exactly what they're doing. They're going down blind alleys. They don't know what – they're lost. They've got to go find their way back because they went the wrong – I mean, it's remarkable. And there's this – one of my favourite bits in terms of the typographic layout and how that physically, because it's, you know, it's, this book is physically manipulating a reader.
Yep.
And that's rare. All books are going to manipulate the readers in terms of how they're written and what they are wanting the reader to know and expect and not expect and what they're hiding from the reader and all that.
Yep.
Every book is a manipulation. That's what authors do. This book, it's physically manipulating the reader, and I don't mean because it breaks your nose if you fall asleep reading it, though it probably would, although I never did. And I have to say, I read this book in 4 days. I just couldn't put it down. This is a book where I actually made time to go and read.
Are you going to find this page?
So there's this bit where you have all these blank pages, and it's you just have a line or a couple of words on each page. So what you're doing is you're turning these pages, and this is about when Navidson is There's a bullet, right? Someone's being shot.
Yes.
Right? And I won't give any more away than that. But you are physically, you're propelling through these pages, and you can probably hear it on the microphone. You're turning these pages really quickly because there's a sentence on each page or a word or something, and then you get to this last one and you turn the page and it just says, saturated in silence, and everything else is white. And that, I mean, you've physically done that. You've physically had the noise of all these turning pages, and then bang, you've got silence.
Yeah.
It's just, it's remarkable. It's remarkable what he's doing to physically manipulate
I'd love
the
to
reader.
Know how he got the publishers to follow his every...
He did it himself.
He laid
he
it
He spent
out himself.
3 weeks on a borrowed computer from Random House and laid out the whole thing himself. So it was perfect.
Yeah, well, there was, would have had an editor. So someone would have looked at the text.
But post that, he did it himself. He laid it out himself. That's how he convinced
them
to
rang
do
him
it.
And said,
he said, give me a computer, I'll do it.
They said, look, we don't know what you really mean, but just give me
a computer.
Yeah.
And really, honestly, any editor at Random House would have just gone, oh, thank God. That job was a nightmare. But that's it. And this book is, I think it's quite remarkable. But you asked me before how I saw the book.
Yes.
Here's how I read the book. Because I haven't gone trawling through the freaking internet and looking.
Oh, what's
at stuff.
It for? What's the internet for if you're not going to trawl?
No, because I don't know. I like this book. I like this book in its isolation.
All right.
So I haven't done an incredibly close reading, but the way I like to think of it, because there's all those bits with the Minotaur.
Yes, that have scratched out.
They're scratched out, which in the colour edition they're in red.
Yes, with the lines still through them.
With the line through them, but yeah. You know, in red. So what Zambano's done is he's written all this stuff about the Minotaur at the middle of a labyrinth, which is what the house is, right? So it makes sense. And then he's gone back at some point before he died and tried to erase all reference to Minotaurs in the house. And this might be a monster that's in the haunted part of the house that actually is chasing people who, because there's growls and we don't know what they are. But there's definitely a sense of menace. And when Zampano dies, there's all these claw marks, or what are described as claw marks, in the floorboards near his corpse. And Johnny Truant thinks he sees a monster at some point.
Yes,
and there's all of this, right? So what I mean, let's forget about whether, you know, that the film isn't real and Zampano isn't real and maybe it's all a mat. What if it is real? What if it's all real? What if there's the house? And what if it doesn't obliterate what's inside itself? Because when they're exploring, like, nothing is left. Their supplies are gone there.
Yep.
Right. And Navidson makes a point, or is it Zampano who makes the point, saying how the house, the anomaly inside the house will not stand anything being left there. It's pristine. It keeps itself pristine.
Yes.
You can't leave stuff. So when Holloway dies, he's gone. We don't know whether they see him again or not. So what if the house won't just not stand stuff being left? What if it won't stand documentation? What if writing about the film? What if making the film? What if the house is getting it all back?
And so the house.
And what if the house is sending its monster to get everything back?
including the people who made the film.
Including the people who made the film.
Literally,
and they're just
them from
gone.
Existence.
They're just gone.
Yeah.
And Zampano at some point realizes this might be what's happening, and he's desperately trying. Well, I won't mention the Minotaur. Maybe that will be enough. If I don't mention the monster, if I cross all that out, if I destroy this, because there's evidence missing, there's bits missing that Truant never found, right? What if I did start destroying it? But it's too late, and the monsters come for him because the house is reclaiming the documentation because the house doesn't want it to know. So it's all real. It's all real. It's all happened. There were neighbors in somewhere. There was a film. It's all being reclaimed.
How do you fit the crazy mum in?
Well, she's Johnny Truant.
But she knew Zampano.
Maybe. We don't know that. There's a thing.
See, you don't like it. I've just gone and thrown a bullet at your theory.
But I'm saying, but if that's it, if the house is reclaiming.
I do love that.
Reclaiming all. And then it is all rumour. And it is things that are on the internet. And it is Johnny Truant finding. Actually, wait, but there are some people who do know about it.
So you're saying that the people who are actually on the internet now talking about it are feeding into.
Maybe they're all going to get clawed up at some point.
So we could get clawed up.
We shouldn't talk about this book anymore.
Okay. I note that Caitlin Keenan reads it every year around Halloween. She said so on a blog.
Okay.
That's pretty dangerous.
Pretty dangerous. Also the house being in blue too, which I really like.
I thought that was
Danielewski has said, because in the colour edition of the book, every time the word house is there,
it's in blue. It doesn't matter what it's
no,
the word house.
The context doesn't matter. Yeah. The house is in blue. He did a search and replace, essentially. I'm spoiling the magic. And sometimes it's the type is slightly offset.
Yes, it is.
But anyway, but what he said, one of the things he said, the specific things that he said, is that he did blue because he hasn't said a lot about the colours because there's some purple in the colour edition as well about the mother. And
yes.
But he said with the blue, he was kind of going for the blue screen thing. Like he chose blue because of how blue screen is used in filmmaking because he's a filmmaker originally. And, you know, blue screen, which was the old green screen that we have now, is the stuff that you put up and then you can superimpose stuff on the top of it. So the house is this void. It's like this emptiness that you can just impose stuff on. It's not there. It's something that's just this thing in the background. But I also think that, and this might be stretching, but what happens when you read a web page and there's a link? What colour is that link?
It's blue.
So every mention of the house in this book is like some little hyperlink into the dimension that the house inhabits. I don't know if that's substantiated.
But you're not obsessed. That's the main thing. You're not obsessed at all with this book.
I'm totally not obsessed. I got no Minotaur coming for me. It's all fiction.
Your description of it actually is quite.
But what
creepy.
If it's real? What if it's real?
Yeah,
what
no,
if
it's quite real? Creepy, and that is the sort of creepiness this book instills.
If you apply, like if you take this Johnny Truant can't find the film and no one's heard of the film now, but what if those people did, what if, you know, Stephen King and Harold Bloom and all those people actually did see and comment on the film at one point and it's just gone now?
Yeah.
And their memory of it
that's
is
actually,
gone now.
That's actually quite funny when he goes to find some of those people.
Yeah, and they go, what
their response, who the hell are you?
What if they did? What if they did see it at some point? What if they did comment at some point and that's just now gone?
Yeah.
Because the house is reclaiming itself, because the house will not bear to be changed or damaged or touched.
I am very interested to know what our listeners think, if they've read House of Leaves, because that actually is
But it's such a creepy book.
It is very creepy. And I want their
Which is opinions. Also an old gothic trope, but, you know, oh, and by the way, this is a true story all along kind of thing. You know, I love this book.
No, but the point is the appendices undermine all that. They seem that the entire point of the appendices seem to be to undermine the narrators. And how reliable they are.
Well, yeah, but what if they're wholly reliable?
Yeah, I get that.
And reality is just being changed.
Yeah, I understand.
And I mean, the index. I find the index fascinating because you've got all these.
You didn't read the index, did you?
No, I haven't gone back and cross-referenced everything. But the index. I mean, the index kind of lends credence to someone who's not mentally or psychologically stable because it's a crazy index. I mean, there's things in the index like the word never. And there's like half a column of references to never.
You know, I didn't actually closely the index.
I mean, this is the thing that you have all these words that I mean, and some are words that you might actually find in an index, like Tom Navidson, Will Navidson, you know, things like that. And then you've got things like murmur and line and lost. Lost gets quite a lot, and man. And things that, like just, the word just has half a column of. And some of these references go for two or three pages. You know, it's an insane index.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, it's and also Minotaur is in there, but it has a DNE, which does not exist. Because Zampano is kind of trying to cover his tracks.
I feel
and
scared.
Johnny Truant's going insane now.
I'm so glad
he's putting it together.
I'm so glad we're doing this in the slightly late afternoon because I'm feeling a bit scared. it's that sort of book.
High Gothic. That's House of Leaves. I love it. Highly recommend it to anyone.
So that's it, really.
That is it.
I'm sorry, guys, but it's going to be a bit of a slightly shorter podcast.
Oh, it's still going to be 90 minutes. Who
oh, really?
Kidding?
Oh, okay. I think definitely House of Leaves. Read that. We highly recommend.
And I think if you've got the time and the space, and I think space is important. I think Infinite Jest is not a book you can pick up and read as I tried to do for half an hour here and there.
Yes,
agreed. I think you need to dedicate.
You need minimum an hour.
And I think you need to dedicate the mental energy to
read
this book.
The David Eggers forward. Anyone who picks up the book in a bookstore, read. Just tell people to get tell the store
when,
owner
when
to
I
keep
try
away
again,
from you.
When I try again,
read the Eggers forward. It is a pep talk. It is its entire aim to get you through. The whole okay. book. All right. So. Highly recommended both those books. Episode 28, which
28.
Will be delayed until probably first, second
because
week of May
babies.
Around then. Yes, because of babies or baby. It's on
hopefully one.
It
is the one.
It's
you sure
one.
About that? I know you don't know the gender yet, but you're sure about the baby part?
They've got technology these days, I can tell you. It's only one.
Maybe the other one's hiding. It's like, or a surprise.
Or, yeah, don't say that. What are you recommending, Kirsten?
I'm recommending a book by M.T. Anderson called Feed.
Is that a man or a woman?
It's a man.
Okay. So you're recommending Feed by M.T. Anderson?
Yep,
that's our
which
second
is a
Feed?
Young, second Feed, yes. Completely different book to the first one. But
then I'm recommending Some Kind of Fairy Tale by Graham Joyce.
I'm so glad you did. Gave me an excuse to buy the book because I'm not supposed to be buying books this year until I've gotten through my To Be Read pile. But, you know, if I have to buy it for the podcast, what am I going to do?
Well, I've read the book. I recommend this because, you know, I've read it.
Excellent.
So this is not what I'm going, oh, I hope it's good. Exactly that voice.
Okay. So there are two books.
Yes.
Much, both of them much shorter than the two we did this month.
Yes.
In fact, I think two of them together would be less than either of those.
Yeah,
two
well,
books.
Some Kind of Fairy Tale is about 300.
Feed's very short.
390 pages or something.
Feed's a very quick read.
So, look, I really want feedback for this episode.
Yeah.
The other 26, I don't give a shit. But this one, this particular one, because of the books, I want feedback. I want to know. What people thought, not you know, whether they would actually give Infinite Jest a crack if they haven't, and whether they've been spooked out by House of Leaves, and what their theory is on House of Leaves, and whether they agree with Kirsten that it's all about.
I don't care if they agree. That's my theory.
I don't care if they don't care. I want to hear what they have to say.
And my reading is legitimate because I read it.
Fine. And whether, if any of them know the sort of people who would trawl and be obsessed with these two books for, you know.
I think I totally would have been obsessed with House of Leaves when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
I think I really would have been one of those people on the forum and dissecting everything page by page and going through. I didn't even bother going through and decoding Perfina's letters this time.
You can on the internet. Someone's done it.
I know. But it's like, well, you don't
oh, my God. Did you do it the first time?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. All right. Oh, I was actually going to ask.
There were letters. There were errant capital letters. And I went, aha, this must be a code.
Well, you know, I was going to ask, though, have you read Only Revolutions?
I have not. I am.
That looks too hard for me.
Yes, but I think I'm May next year when I'm allowed to.
It's
buy
got
books
a Finnegan's
again.
Wake feel to it. I'm not touching
it's
it.
It's pretty. Looks
it,
very pretty.
It looks gorgeous, but that's not for me. I actually wouldn't mind though hearing what people.
Anyone, you want me to read it?
If any of our listeners have read Only Revolutions by, and I look, I mean,
I think what he's do, I think what Danielewski's doing is really amazing things.
He's
with
written
the book
two
as a
books,
form, but with the well, it's taken him freaking 10 years to write each one. This is the thing about works of genius, if you want to call them that. They take a long time. They take quite. Einstein didn't come up with his theory of relativity over coffee one day when he was thinking about. Walking his dog instead. I mean, it takes a long time to produce great work.
He's written a third book, which is much shorter.
Well, the whale story is just the letters, I think. Is
no,
there a one in
no,
between?
There is another thing okay. as well. Not just the letters from okay. Perfina, which is why they're important, which is why she's the nutty
yeah.
woman in the...
Maybe. Well, they're just letters.
Okay. We're not going back. You had your chance to talk about House of Leaves. And
I did. I did
only
a great length.
And Only Revolutions, but you didn't decide to bring up Only Revolutions. No, you relied on me. Me.
We were talking about that book.
I was going to even buy it. Then I reminded myself why I didn't buy it the first time because it's far too hard. So comment at the website. We want comments. writerandcritic.podbean.com. Email is writerandcritic@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, which people are.
They are. You're managing the Twitter account.
Yes.
So if you don't get a reply from Writer and Critic at Twitter, blame Ian. It's not me.
It's and we've got over 100 and nearly 120 followers on the Twitter account.
Nice.
But more than that, listen to us. I know that. So okay. Where are those people? Aren't they following us? And you know, rating on iTunes with the 5 stars. Anyway, I'm off. I'm done. We're done. We have to give Dave his house back.
So everyone gets a month off. Again,
yeah.
I'm so sorry.
But then we'll be more.
This is the most unreliable podcast ever.
Just this year. Come on, we produced 26 episodes without a hitch. It's just been, you know, 28. Yeah. Will take a bit of time. But look, if we drag this out for another half hour, people will have, you know.
No, never mind. We're going. Okay. We're going. We'll see you in May.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye. That's Ian going crazy after all the podcasting.